Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 60, section 3. We got a little ways in. We're ready to start the fourth paragraph, which is on old single column, page 689. And so like I just said, that fourth paragraph, the paragraph that starts with the number 100 million there, 100 million years ago. So recall, we just did that little preface at the end of the preceding session because we wanted to get to that little milestone point that they were so much building us up to and building us up to, pardon the pun, the modern mountain building stage. Yeah, there's an italics there, you see, at the beginning of that third paragraph. And as we get into the actual stepping through the blocks of time here, of the Cretaceous, we will, we'll see precisely when they indicate that transition from that currently unrecognized long span of the basic dominant type of crustal process that was going on with the Earth that we can call continental drift, and when it shifts to plate tectonics. Okay? And you want to think about, like we were talking so much about last time, how that, amongst all the other phenomena, are setting the stage for humans being on the planet in the not-too-distant future. All of this is very much, reaching crescendo sort of a flavor relative to the hundreds of millions of years that, we've been going through. It's all the more pre-human. And the more pre-human it gets, it's not just in the nature of the biology, but it's in the nature of the full system. Right? Because what's evolving is the whole, not any particular part or a collection of parts. The whole is evolving, and the parts evolve in the context of the whole. Right? They're taken along for a ride with the whole. Because the God of evolution is not the individuality of the parts. It's not God the Father. Right? It's God the Mother. Right? The God, the face of personalized deity that engages the whole. Right? So that just tells you very directly in terms of the logic of what's going on, right, that the whole is what's fundamentally evolving. And the parts come along with it. Okay, and the way they've been, precisely speaking about this transition from continental drift to plate tectonics, they don't use the expression plate tectonics, or at least so it appears, right? But every time they say building, like right there, italicized modern mountain building stage, what does the word tectonics mean literally? Building. Okay. Right. So, it is very directly saying we've reached the point where mountains are going to be built in the way we think of mountains being built, relative to recent times. That occurs because the crust is finally cooled to the point that there are plates and not this more plastic-like crust that's been kind of shifting about. Okay? So that's the little hitter about all we need to get ourselves back in the flow of what they're about to give us in detail. Besides that main point, all they did in those initial preface paragraphs here is kind of just foreshadow what they're going to describe in detail. So we can pick up on the specifics as we step through on the details. You know, you can see from, you know, remind yourself of the title there, the Cretaceous stage, the flowering plant period, and the age of birds. So you know two of the biggies that are coming up, right? You're going to get flowering plants and true birds, finally, in the evolutionary process. All right, let's see what they've got for us here.
100 million years ago, the North American continent and a part of Europe were well above water. The warping of the American continents continued, resulting in the metamorphosing of the South American Andes and in the gradual elevation of the western plains of North America. Most of Mexico sank beneath the sea, and the southern Atlantic encroached on the eastern coast of South America, eventually reaching the present shoreline. The Atlantic and Indian Oceans were then about as they are today.
Okay, so you can see how they open with just the basic geologic issues that we were just bringing up. You notice that in that second sentence, they still are using the word warping. Right, so you know they are indicating that even though, as we've seen here for quite a while, it's that the crust, you know, is definitely getting more and more solid, but it hasn't gotten sort of fully there yet. So they're still saying you have some of this still more plastic, you know, flexible sort of adjustment that's going on, and you can definitely see it there. I mean, besides the stuff is still definitely going up and down a lot, right, because of all the warping. But more specifically about how we're getting close to that setting of the stage for plate tectonics being done by this more warping sort of an evolutionary process, when they say that the southern Atlantic encroached on the eastern coast of South America, eventually reaching the present shoreline. You know, so think about, you know, not like current scientists think of, you know, they've been rigid plates forever, and, you know, you just have these rigid plates that have opened up and made the Atlantic as it is today, you know, and it's still opening up right now. But, you know, yes, there's some of that, but before that, there was some of this more continental drift-like adjusting to the point where things are rigid and then are moving apart. And so obviously they're telling you that, you know, for a long time, like I've reminded you occasionally, you don't want to think so separate in terms of the continents like we do now, right? It's been just sort of quasi-separate continents, you know, deepening ocean basins. And here you can see, you know, that the South America used to be much bigger to the east, obviously. And all of that kind of just sunk, and then things hardened, and then it is what it is, you know? So, you know, if you kind of wonder, it always seemed a little bit odd that South America was so narrow at the bottom, right? You can see how that came to be, right? It just about all became ocean, you know, but there was just a little sliver left when it hardened, you know, and got to this more rigid state of today. Okay, so that's what they're, you know, they're sort of just between the lines giving you a little hint, you know, that even a child staring at the map, you know, of the world and wondering, gee, why is that so thin down there? You know, little questions, innocent questions you can ask like that. But they're the kind of questions that easily get glossed over when you get sophisticated, quote unquote, in your thinking, right? You forget that the first things that your theories should be answering are those most basic facts that even the little child notices, right? Hence the old thing about the emperor, you know, has no clothes, and who, you know, informs everyone of that, you know, the child, not the sophisticated quote unquote adults, right? There's many areas like that in human thought, not just in various areas of science, where they've got an elaborate rationalization scheme that doesn't answer the most, you know, basic fact in play. Answers all the other stuff, the 10th order stuff, but doesn't answer the first order questions. Like, what's the first order fact about the solar system? That the planets are not in the plane of the sun's equator. So you think, certainly, their theory addresses that most basic fact and then gets to the details later. No, it ignores that most basic fact, lots of stuff is like that. The fact that your theory is not likely to be true is staring you right in the face, right? And the little child could raise his hand and point out that the king has, the emperor has no clothes. It's unfortunate that college-age kids aren't motivated before they get to college to be in that kind of a state where they would raise their hand and ask their professor an awkward question, right? Instead, they've been primed to be indoctrinated and brainwashed, and then they are, right? In various dogmas. Every time I go off on that, on a tangent, apparent seeming tangent like that, it's just to remind you how much is there in basically every sentence that you could, play off of, take note of. The Revelations only have 2,000 pages to give you infinity. They haven't wasted words. Okay? Every sentence is there with some greater purpose. No matter how seemingly merely factual and mundane it is, right, there's nothing in here where the point is to disclose facts fundamentally. It's all about truth, revealing truth. Okay. But the other thing there that I alluded to a second ago, you can see that even though we're getting this close to things getting much more rigid with the crust, there's a lot of up and downing still happening. Continents are up above water. No, now they're all underwater. Now they're up above water. That is still going on just like it has for hundreds of millions of years. All right.
I think all that heaving is kind of work hardening the crust in a really practical sense.
Yeah, I mean, right? I mean, the dough is getting kneaded. There's no doubt about it. Yes.
You're going to make it the best piece.
It's being flexed, and so things can eventually sort of all be locked into place. Think about how long it takes, for the amorphous nature of, window glass, to get itself rearranged plastically until it can be in a more crystalline state. Decades and decades and decades roll by, and slowly it's, that window glass is rearranging itself and trying to get more crystalline. And if you look at very old glass, it's settled, it's thicker at the bottom of the pane than at the top of the pane. And if you see sun shining through it, you'll see the little bit of a magnifying, effect of the sunshine on the floor, you've got that sort of thing happening, that very slow plastic reordering of things to try to get it to the point where it can kind of lock in. Yeah. All right. So very quickly, so just one little comment, and then boom, we're going to jump to 95 million years ago. But before we do that, we should make one other little note. We've kind of lost track of that. We remember how we've been kind of keeping track of, how is the date ratio doing? As you start the Cretaceous here, the date ratio is starting to come down. Remember how it was at way back there at the beginning of the Cambrian, it was at 1.4 roughly, and it seemed like there was a genuine gentle slope up to about 1.6, where it was in the Jurassic and the Triassic. But as you begin the Cretaceous here at 100 million years ago, it's 1.4 now. It's dropping. And it'll be down to 1.3 by the end of the Cretaceous, and heading down rapidly to a ratio of 1. Right, so there's something going on. A basically uniform level is suddenly dropping. And we also are just in the wake of sort of a quasi little maximum to that gentle, apparently gentle upslope. And so, you know, we're kind of looking for any signs and anything they say about why that might have been happening. Is there any indication that that's there's some purpose behind that, at least indirectly? Yeah. That the life carriers and the master physical controllers might be up to something in terms of what they're doing here with life or the planet in general, and maybe there's this side effect where it's affecting the radioactivity, you know, rate. We want to kind of keep our eye open for anything like that that might kind of stand out as something that has passed and, you know, it indicate a new phase, you know, in play. Okay, so let's go forward here.
95 million years ago, the American and European land masses again began to sink. The southern seas commenced the invasion of North America and gradually extended northward to connect with the Arctic Ocean, constituting the second greatest submergence of the continent. When this sea finally withdrew, it left the continent about as it now is. Before this great submergence began, the eastern Appalachian Highlands had been almost completely worn down to the water's level. The many colored layers of pure clay now used for the manufacture of earthenware were laid down over the Atlantic coast regions during this age, their average thickness being about 2,000 feet.
Yeah, I mean, if any of you are familiar with, eastern coast, you might be familiar with, you know, large clay beds, like, say, Martha's Vineyard, something like that. That's what they're referring to here. You know, so if you aren't familiar, you know, when they talk about mud in general, you know, scientifically, very, very fine-grained is clay. And the finest grained. If it's a little coarser, it's silt. You know, and if it's coarser yet, it's sand. Or you might even do things like, to indicate a spectrum, you've got, you know, a clay or a clay stone. It's a little grainier. You have a mud or a mudstone, and a little grainier yet, you have a silt or a siltstone. You know, you have basically shale. Right, you know, if it's a rock, but you know, if you want to really get into details about exactly what the grain size is, right. So you know, they're just reminding you that all the beautiful, very, very finely eroded material that got piled up there came from somewhere, right? Right. The whole eastern highlands had just haven't been totally worn down to sea level. And piled up as a delightful big pile of future earthenware. Now, again, you know, why throw in the earthenware comment? Why not keep it in a very dry scientific mode? Right? Because this is all about the evolution of humans. Right? If you're going to have an evolving human civilization, starting in a very primitive state, at some point, that human civilization needs clay to make pottery. Oh, coincidentally, clay evolves and is available, you know, just like with the Carboniferous. You're going to need fossil fuels. Oh, coincidentally, right, you know, there are no coincidences in supremacy, right? It's quote-unquote coincidentally, right? And it's all there because it's what humans need. Everything that humans need is all in place before humans need it, you know. And you know, and that's just as much an issue of fact like that as we've pointed out in truth. You know, before animals need shells Because there's predators, they have shells. Right? Because those are what humans look like way back then, right? I mean, the evolutionary process takes care of, you know, those early shelled creatures just as lovingly as it does us today, because in truth, it's all us, right? Every trilobite is loved just as much as, you know, as a human, right? I mean, from a highest perspective, right? Yes, in fact, a trilobite's not a person, right, as an individual. It doesn't have a personal relationship with God the Father. It's not encircuited in the Father's personality circuit, yes. Right? But in truth, right, the whole system is under a holistic loving care. And every part is within that sphere of love from God the Mother, the God of evolution. Right? So nothing can get out of that loving presence if it even wanted to. Right? Inescapably, everything has that kind of care attached to it. Right? And the God of evolution, God the Mother, sees to it that there's a raw material for earthenware. Right? And power plants and, you know, and everything else. Okay. So that they're always they don't force that on you very often. Every once in a while we saw they kind of really sort of push it, you know, out there. But it's always there, they're wanting you to recognize that. The truth of what's happening here. You know, even colored layers. Right, because humans like to have different colors, and right, I mean, right, it's pleasing. I mean, it's all there. Just appreciate that, the beauty of that, the wholeness of that. Okay, and 2,000 feet's a lot of clay. All right. But yeah, then at the beginning. You know, when they comment about the second greatest submergent of the continent. If you look back, I think that it's the great submergence in the Cambrian that's number one. I mean, there's a number of pretty significant submergences, but I think that's what they're comparing to here, is the one where, you know, everything is very, almost totally underwater back there in the Cambrian. And then this is number two. And then, you know, just those amazing things like the Southern Seas, you know, heading north and connecting to the Arctic Ocean, you know, just as they keep indicating various things like that happening, you know, just to remind you of how different, you know, it's been in the past. Yep.
So let's compare this to Pavona, where there's not an evolutionary process like we were talking
right
about, a perfecting process.
Correct, yeah.
So you're basically saying this is the story of a perfecting process here on Earth, headed towards... But when Havona was created, you know, building the worlds, they didn't go through this particular kind of process. And whether there's mud there or not, you know, we'll find out. But if it's there, mm-hmm, it was fiatly created, correct?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm just thinking that... The differences between the two are kind of interesting to think
and
over.
Fundamentally, the only difference between the two is time. I mean, if you just take the finger snap, you know, as it were, fiat creation of the central universe, I mean, that's a creative act. There is a substance to that creative act. Just take that finger snap and slow it down. Stretch it out so you can see all the details of the finger snap. That's evolution. It's just the fiat finger snap laid out over time. If you ball it all up, the eventually of all that is just like a finger snap. And, yeah, so, I mean, evolution is creativity and time. It's creativity. Yeah, the only difference is just stretch it out in an apparent linear sequence. So that you can appreciate all of the logic that's embodied and invisible in that fiat finger snap of making the central universe. There's an internal logic there that's not, you know, doesn't manifest. But here you can see the internal workings of creation, the creative act laid out. And what it takes logically in that finger snap, you know, in each nanosecond of it for it to happen. Right? Certain things have to precede certain other things logically in that fiat moment. Yep.
I don't think there are planets set aside as quarries and transport vehicles bringing in the dirt.
There's not in the central universe, but yeah, that brings up this you know, this issue we've brought up a number of times. We've been reading here in part three. You know, what becomes of all the uninhabited worlds? Do they get used? Some of them get used in very overt fashion like that, trillions of years from now or whatever. You know, or what? I mean, some things, it's hard to imagine creatures ever using them as raw materials for anything. So you have to think, well, I guess at some point, the Almighty Supreme is going to just swallow all that up and do something with it or something. You know, what becomes of Jupiter and Saturn and, you know, I mean, you know, and all this stuff. I mean, right, you don't have a whole bunch of barren wasteland worlds in the central universe. Right, there's just a billion inhabited worlds, period. Right, there's not one little micrometeorite, you know, floating around anywhere in there. There's not even a single grain of sand that's, you know, astray between those worlds. Not one molecule of gas, even, right? So there's a lot of gas and dust and all sorts of junk, you know, out here. What happens to all that stuff? It's a giant mystery. The Revelators don't know any more than we do.
Future architectural spheres.
Well, the thing is, you know, you could maybe suspect that, but your first suspicion is from what some of the things they say about paradise is that you take the current architectural worlds plus the evolutionary inhabited worlds, and that, and you get the total of all the worlds. So, yeah, you know, it's mysterious to know exactly what. You know, and it's an extremely inefficient way to have to deconstruct all of that matter to ultimate tonic level, and then construct an architectural world out of that. You know, from the automatons up. That seems pointless. But there's some huge mysteries. What about the dark islands of space, you know, and stuff like that? I mean, there's just all this mysterious, you know, matter. Who knows what becomes of it?
Some universes that are very far along evolved were, or some solar systems from the very beginning that have the answer to that. We don't know.
Well,
maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, how far along there are, if there are areas that are very, very cleared in some way or something, I don't know. I mean, one little hint that you have, you know, kind of along your lines of about how there can be some pretty grand artificial things. You know, remember that you have stars that give off light without heat for the super universe headquarters worlds. All right, so you got, you know, whole star-sized things that have been, you know, put together in some way, you know, and are sort of like conduits, for central universe luminosity, kind of, you know. I mean, so there could be some very dramatic things, you know, that come of all this matter, you know, that, you know, maybe just, maybe it's all turned into lighthouses, as it were, you know, to illuminate the, you know, the domain of the super universe level as things are extended out from the central universe, right? And the super universe level sort of becomes, you know, part of that whole inner system for the absentite beings, you know, coming in from the outside. I mean, who knows? You can speculate. It'll be something cool. You know, the Almighty Supreme will do something really cool with all that. But what? No one knows. Except absentite beings, right?
They can just encircuit an existing sun and make it one of these fixed output devices.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty readily. I mean, it's they don't unfold it and fold it up again.
Right. I mean, see, you know, you could say, well, maybe they just collect up all the extraneous matter and put it into the eternalized stars, you know, and make it part of them. See, I don't know. I mean, you can speculate. anyway. Okay, let's see. So where were we? Oh, yeah, we got that little paragraph there.
Great volcanic actions occurred south of the Alps and along the line of present California Coast Range mountains. The greatest crustal deformations in millions upon millions of years took place in Mexico. Great changes also occurred in Europe, Russia, Japan, and southern South America. The climate became increasingly diversified.
Okay, so two things basically there, aside from the immediate facts. You can see signs that things are hardening up. All right, the greatest crustal deformations in millions upon millions of years took place. I mean, that's because things are getting more and more rigid, and they're starting to, you know, come under tension one with the other, you know, like the plates, and things are snapping and crumpling, and you know, you get all kinds of radical deformation of all these beautifully laid down horizontal beds. You know, things are folded and crushed, and okay, so it's because things are getting more rigid, and you notice they throw in the little thing about we are definitely getting more and more of continental climate issues setting in. Right? As you'll see in a little bit here, we haven't gone all the way. There's definitely still some marine climate, you know, phenomena going on. But even if it's still not as big a difference of temperature between the poles and the equator, right, it hasn't gone that far to continental climate. Yeah, you at least have a lot more variability, you know, from one region to another, rather than just, you know, everywhere, you know, all the way around and, you know, equator to pole, it's all the same, right? Okay. Okay, but see, just jumping along, you know, these 5 million year chunks here now, you see. You know, you notice that we've been going along in these 10 million year chunks, and all of a sudden, they're picking up the pace. It's getting smaller and smaller as we go forward and get closer and closer to the first two humans. You have this geometric phenomenon happening that they sort of literally indicate by giving you shorter time steps. Right? I mean, obviously they could have said everything they said for 100 million and 95 million all in one block. But they broke it into two, right? Just to give you that sense of you have more and more of the nonlinear influence of spirit through mind on matter, right? There's a more and more geometric pace. They're trying to indicate that by just taking smaller time steps, and noticing more and more that there is something kind of significantly different, you know, in those two smaller time steps. And it is an artificial, just merely an artificial addition. Okay? I have another tick on the ruler, you know? Okay?
90 million years ago, the angiosperms emerged from these early Cretaceous seas and soon overran the continents. These land plants suddenly appeared, along with fig trees, magnolias, and tulip trees. Soon after this time, fig trees, breadfruit trees, and palms overspread Europe and the western plains of North America. No new land animals appeared.
Okay, so two things there again. So flowering plants.
Is that an angiosperm?
Angiosperms are flowering plants, yes. You have modified seeds that are related to flowering plants. Because remember, we went from spores to seeds a little earlier. Right? Now we're going to angiosperms, that type of seed, you know, with flowering plants and fruits, various fruits. Okay, and that's a huge, huge deal. As they'll stress in a little later on here. And you can get kind of a sense of that just by the little tiny sentence they added at the end. No new land animals appeared. All right, so think about, you have this purposed holistic evolution happening. You know, and at this particular time, there's a focus in that system, not on the animals, but on the plants. Why? Right, think in holistic terms. Well, something must be about to happen with the animals, and you have to have the plants in a certain stage ready before that happens with the animals. And that's exactly, you know, what's going on. We're about to have mammals, right? And you need to get these fully advanced plants in place and, you know, established and widespread. You can see they rapidly are spreading, as they're indicating there. So that's what's going on. There's a lot of human evolution that has a factual expression in the plant life at this point, as opposed to in the animal life. Yep.
Yeah, so I assume that the spread of the vegetation, the variety of vegetation, was due to the birds?
Well, I mean, obviously you have things like, various creatures, spreading stuff around, the wind and whatnot. But the more important spread, that horizontal thing, don't just think of the literal geographic, migration of things, but think about the adaptation. When they say no new land animals appeared, okay, so you don't have any vertical evolution of any, great significance in the animals. Obviously, you had a huge vertical suddenly there with the plants, okay, but you often have lots and lots of horizontal evolution where it's spreading into the various niches, and evolving, adapting, so that adaptive horizontal evolution into this niche and this niche and this niche, and okay? Just think about, and they said in the previous paragraph, the climate became increasingly diversified. Ah, see, there's going to be all the more horizontal evolution because there's all of that variability in climate and, that the life is going to adapt into. So the more variable things are in terms of climate, geography, and whatnot, the more horizontal evolution there is, right? When everything was basically uniform climate all over the planet, see, there wasn't even the potential for things to evolve horizontally relative to that external stimulus. But that's coming into play now, right? And that's getting more and more important. You're going to need it to be able to diversify a lot horizontally, as we talked about, I think it was the preceding session, right? Because it's got to go all over horizontally and find that path that can go upward. Right? It can't go upward anywhere in the adaptive plane, right? But so it searches around basically, and it finds the way that it can progress upward. It needs to do that more and more, because eventually we're going to get more and more specific, and we got to find the place where you can go up to humans, right? Right. So you see, everything is in play for that. Coincidentally, the environment fosters more horizontal evolution when more horizontal evolution is needed. It's a whole system evolving. The elegance of it. All right, so we got this big focus on angiosperms. Again, this, like I said, it's the details are pregnant with, with something here. You can expect something big to be coming in the not too distant future here. Plants as fancy as flowering plants, right, presage something profound.
And tulip trees?
Yeah, stuff like tulip trees and whatnot.
We have tulip trees.
Yes, we have tulip trees, yes. Yes, dude.
It's interesting that these new plants came out of the seeds.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I was going to mention that. Thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah, Gene is pointing out that very important point. Emerged from the early Cretaceous seas. Yes, thank you so much. I needed to bring up that point. That's another key thing that we've seen here so many times about this parallel evolutionary phenomenon. That's not like humans think about it now in such simplistic linear fashion, right? Where you have all these potentials for land plants in sea plants. And often, right, when something radically new appears as the land plants, like they're pointing out here, it doesn't do that predicated on the pre-existent land plants. Sometimes these suddenly drop back, you know, and feed out of the potentials at that sort of basal level again. And it comes out onto the land anew from the sea. Yeah, see, that's a very important point that we've seen a number of times where, you know, they rationalize, they put all the fossils, you know, down in front of themselves, and they try to put them together in a line where they think, well, this is, you know, intermediate between that thing and that other thing, okay? And so it must have gone in that order, one, two, three. No, it may be two things, you know, at the level of item number one here, and one of them went to two, and another one went to the three. Right? One took a small jump from a common, basically common starting point, and another, you know, species at that level took an even bigger jump. Okay? It doesn't always work that way, but sometimes, like they're pointing out here, it does. Okay? Sometimes, you know, it is kind of stepping along, this leads to this, leads to this, leads to this, but other times it drops back to a deeper source and makes a new jump forward and jumps even further. The breadfruit tree, yes.
Do you suppose that it being a crustaceous sea, you know, might have more calcium?
No, that's, remember, the Cretaceous is called Cretaceous because that means clay.
Play. Ah, never mind.
Yeah.
Blows that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, we remember they mentioned that up front. That's just, you know, just literally means clay. Yep.
Do you think from the previous paragraph that we read from the flooding from the southern seas, do you think some of that plant migration came from the south because of that flood?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of stuff is in play a lot. I mean, they don't mention it, but every time there's these big new channels that open and the seas get radically readjusted, a whole bunch of species die off and new species, you know, come into existence, you know, because it upsets the whole balance of everything. Either you mix carnivores, you know, with others that weren't mixed before, or the sea gets too warm or too cold, and everything that likes it warmer or colder dies off, and yeah, all those sorts of big things like that. There's massive extinctions, in, you know, involved in every big change like that, and so yeah, I mean, it could have been a stimulus, right? And suddenly, right, the system, the biologic system, evolved to that stimulus, and you get this new species that crops up.
So after the seas receded, and they could have actually made a temperature change in that 5 million year period.
Yeah, you'll see they'll mention there. You know, some of these changes, you know, lead to, you know, very radical.
Because a lot of these plants that they're describing here, I don't see in the northern hemisphere.
Right. Yeah. Certainly, some of those are tropical. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Where are the true tulip trees?
That's your assignment, to go find true tulip trees, right?
I can't wait to look
at
it.
You have this lovely purple and white grained.
You have one?
Tulip wood. You would really love the color of it.
All right. Okay, but you know, but again, you know, remember, it's been a long time since we've stressed it with all these italicized suddenlies, right? That's not an interventionary phenomenon. That's an That's all natural, those suddenlies. Those are phase changes in the system. And so there's, you know, there's, it's a complex phenomenon where there's this steady influence that's imposed upon the system in various ways. Like I was just indicating, that that may manifest in altering of the land and sea and whatnot. And, you know, there's a, the system is evolving and there's this constant influence on it, and suddenly there's a phase change in that system. And what we can appreciate in retrospect is how, oh, coincidentally, that all fits together now, even better than it did before. Those phase changes are never going to spurt out something that is completely out of sync with everything else around it. You know, that's kind of what I've been hinting at is, you know, you, when you're going to get a very definitive something going vertical and poking up, you know, it doesn't find itself as up there as an island universe with no environment, you know, that's up at its level to support it. Coincidentally, all the stuff that it needs, you know, poked up before and is there waiting for it. Right? All right. All right, let's keep going here.
85 million years ago, Bering Strait closed, shutting off the cooling waters of the northern seas. Theretofore, the marine life of the Atlantic Gulf waters and that of the Pacific Ocean had differed greatly, owing to the temperature variations of these two bodies of water, which now became uniform.
I told you that we were going to mention that just right here in the next paragraph. So, right, I mean, you know, if and you go, well, wait a minute, isn't it open, the top of the Atlantic? No, not like it is now. I mean, back then, that, you know, it, that was all solid there. You had a complete, solid land from you know, North America, quote unquote, over to Europe, right? You know, and the remnants of that are Greenland and whatnot, right? Right, so all that was solid, and a lot of times it was solid across the Bering Strait as well, as they're pointing out. You know, not always; it can be open. But if it shuts off like it is here, right, then you're not going to have all that cold. Because finally now it's colder water in the Arctic, because we've got a more continental climate. Before, it didn't matter if it was open or closed. I mean, the water at the North Pole was the same temperature as the water at the equator when it was marine climate. But now that you're getting some continental climate, and there's a definite, you know, it's definitely cooler. It's not super cold yet, but definitely cooler at the pole. Right? If you cut off the Bering Strait, now you're going to have, you know, similar water temperatures. And obviously that could cause huge problems to all the marine life in the Pacific Ocean when suddenly it's a lot warmer than they're used to, and probably a whole bunch of stuff is going to die off, right? I mean, when you look at the fossil record, you know, there's just, you know, one massive extinction after another. Nothing as huge as the Permian extinction, you know, we read about a while back, but, you know, very major extinctions all the time, and this is why, you know. You know, little passing comments like that, you know, imply death, massive death, you know. okay. There's going to be a lot of stuff piled up on the ocean floor, turned into, you know, limestone or something, right? Okay. Yep.
I was thinking the vertical, I've been losing my voice all day, evolution of a plant is a lot like our evolution of our mind and spirit, where it's held in an evolution that's kind of gentle in a way, and we fit in, even if we don't totally fit in. We don't stick out like sore thumbs necessarily.
Yeah.
So it made me think we're a lot like those plants.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the thing about humans is, you know, you're given free will. You actually can choose to bring more spirit down into relationship with your mind and have the mind go up. And because of choice, you can find yourself up there kind of all alone. You know, the rest of the planet hasn't been brought by the evolutionary process up to where you've chosen to be, you know, to be lifted up to.
But you still fit in in the evolution where you don't look like
biologically, no. But mentally, all of a sudden, you don't fit in. It's all of a sudden, your longtime best friends, you can't really relate to them anymore. And, you know, because it's like, well, you just don't think in those simple terms anymore.
But you can still fit in even with that level without being some kind of freak.
Right, but you get my point. See, I mean, you know why I'm bringing that up, because you got something in your lap. The more you definitively identify with it, you're going to have this happen to you. Suddenly, you're going to find yourself up there kind of a fish out of water, right, with a lot of people. You know, you're going, well, how about them Broncos? You know, how about the weather? You know, you can't really talk about anything too substantive because, you know, immediately it's, you know, they're confused.
I was just with you today where I was trying to figure out what to talk about. But there is always a way to talk.
I mean, fortunately, you can go back. You can, you know, you don't burn those bridges.
Yeah.
But the thing, the new burning things in your mind, are ahead of where a lot of people are. It doesn't make you better in the eyes of God the Father, right? I mean, you can't increase how much He loves you. You can't decrease how much He loves you, right? He loves everyone absolutely, no matter how, you know, simple-minded or primitive or whatever, or advanced or whatever they are philosophically, right? But that mind issue, set God the Father aside. In terms of your relationship to the whole, you have an elevated relationship and recognition of the whole of things that, you know, those people coming up behind you don't have yet. Like they point out, inexorably, the Supreme evolves, and, you know, people are elevated. And eventually, the norm on the planet will be very advanced. You know, especially if you're, you know, in the wake of an epical revelation, if you choose to identify with the teachings of that revelation, you might find yourself a bit of an oddball on the earth.
I always say I come from the oddball brigade.
You know, and, you know, Jesus, you know, even with the fourth epical revelation, you know, Jesus, remember, he reminded everyone of that. It's like, if you really take a hold of what's going to come in the wake of what I'm doing here, right? Universal bestowal of thought adjusters and the spirit of truth poured out upon all flesh. If you really choose to take delight in cultivating, having a mind that can benefit from those ministries and be uplifted by those ministries, that truth will divide families in two. Right? It will very much, cut right down the middle of old relationships, and can be very problematic. Truth is rugged that way. All right. Meanwhile, back to the story here of tulip trees and such, which some find very, very intriguing and need to investigate them.
I'm gonna Google it.
All right. What happens next here?
The deposits of chalk and green sand marl give name to this period. The sedimentations of these times are variegated, consisting of chalk, shale, sandstone, and small amounts of limestone, together with inferior coal or lignite, and in many regions they contain oil. These layers vary in thickness from 200 feet in some places to 10,000 feet in western North America and numerous European localities. Along the eastern borders of the Rocky Mountains, these deposits may be observed in the up-tilted foothills.
Oh, well, I think we got to start with the end of the paragraph first, don't we? Right. So remember, we're in the Cretaceous, okay? And a lot of regions that we're familiar with around here, there's a very significant sandstone bed that was deposited during the Cretaceous. And when everything gets turned up, the Rocky Mountain uplift, all those beds get tipped up, and a very thick relatively resilient bed of sandstone is not going to weather away as easily as, you know, finer sort of stuff, you know, more shale and whatnot like stuff. And so, you know, that bed, you know, that's tipped up might end up forming a ridge, right? A hogback, right, along the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, right? The Dakota hogback is what they're talking about here, that Dakota sandstone, right? With the Morrison, which is softer, see underneath it, right? And it erodes away and forms a swale there. Now, you know, when you think of, up-tilted foothills, I mean, the first thing you probably think of is like the Flatirons, mm-hmm. Right? Okay, but, that's much older. You see, think about it, you know, you've got turned up. So the Cretaceous is there, the hogback, and the Morrison, that's the Jurassic, you know. As you go in towards the actual igneous mountains, right, you're getting older and older. That fountain formation, you know, that is the literal Flatirons, you know, or red rocks, or, you know, Garden of the Gods, or whatnot, that's Pennsylvanian. That's clear back in the Carboniferous. Mm-hmm. Right, so this span we've been reading, since it started getting interesting from the Carboniferous to now, that's all right out your window. Okay? You can go from the Carboniferous, the upper Carboniferous, the Pennsylvanian, right, to the Cretaceous, just scanning with your eye, and out your window, looking west.
Or a car ride.
And isn't that interesting? Ever since the Carboniferous, it's gotten really related to humans a lot. A lot of stuff they're saying. And there it is, for us humans to all just see right on display, right in front of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what they're talking about, hogbacks, like we have here. All right, so the rest of the material there. Remember, like I just said a minute ago, Cretaceous literally means chalk. You know, the root word means chalk. You also have other soft stuff, like marl. Marl is lime-rich mud, or mudstone, basically. It's lime-rich. So instead of just having plain old mud, you know, really fine or grittier or whatnot, like we were talking about before, you can mix in some calcium carbonate, you know, with it and get marl. And then the greensand marl thing is kind of a technical issue. There's various deposits that are called greensands because there's a mineral in them that's green. Okay, so that's kind of there for the geologists to recognize what's behind that. If you're interested, you know, do a little Wikipedia searching or something. You can find out a little bit more about it. As I said, we don't want to go into all the science here so much, you know, immediately. Okay, but we've got, it's kind of a hodgepodge, like they're saying, variegated. And here's that lignite. Remember, when we were talking about the coal, you know, they mentioned anthracite, you know, the hardest stuff, you know, back there specifically. And then we talked a little bit about how you have that whole spectrum where you have anthracite, you know, it's actually, you know, very metamorphosed and hard. And then you have bituminous, you know, lesser quality. Then you have sub-bituminous, yet lesser quality. And then you have lignite, right, the lowest quality. Mm-hmm. See, in this most recent stuff, you know, like you have up there in North Dakota and eastern Montana, right? A lot of big lignite deposits up there. See, it's not as hard and stuff because it's so much younger, right? It hasn't gotten deeply buried and, you know, and transformed into harder stuff. You know, and a lot of lignite, I mean, it's so young. I mean, it basically looks like tree, you know, still. The blackened tree. You know, it almost looks like, you know, just a burnt tree, charcoal sort of, you know. I mean, it's so close to just being wood still. So, yep.
I was told once that lignite is so unstable that if a power plant is built to burn it, it needs to be built close to the source because transporting lignite mm-hmm. is dangerous because it can ignite?
Well, there's lots of dust because it's so, you know, I mean, there's obviously that. But also just, you know, it's really fascinating. You can, if you can get a great big chunk of lignite, and it looks really cool, you know, it's intriguing, kind of like petrified wood is intriguing, you know. You know, this the structure of it. You go, oh, this is a cool thing, and it's not that heavy. You know, so you can get a big chunk of it. I want to take a chunk of this home and have it. You know, this is really cool. But, of course, it turns into a pile of dust in pretty short order because it has no integrity to it, so you can't keep it. it's not a very fun pet rock because it just falls into dust. You see, it's kind of complicated like that because it's just so fragile.
And, the spark from the train hit the...
Yeah, obviously, you know, yeah. You've got those issues, yeah. Okay, let's see. So we've got our lignite and oil. And so just a little reminder, you started storing up fossil fuels for humans in a big way there with the Carboniferous, but it didn't stop. And, and in many ways, the more the technology grows, the more you can use the lesser quality stuff. And so there's kind of a range there that spans the range of technology and its ability to use it. All right, let's see. Let's read that next little chunk there.
All over the world, these strata are permeated with chalk, and these layers of porous semi-rock pick up water at upturned outcrops and convey it downward to furnish the water supply of much of the Earth's present arid regions.
All right, so one of the ways you can have aquifers supplied is... because a lot of times stuff necessarily can't, go straight down. There's impermeable layers. You know, the rainwater can't penetrate all the way down. But it's somewhere, right? There's stuff upturned, there's like a straw, right? That's stuck up over here. And you can pour it in way over there where that porous bed is upturned. The water just flows in, long distances horizontally and gives you this beautiful aquifer way over here. That people can drill well down to and tap. So, see, just all of this, this chaos, apparent chaos of, you have all this beautiful stuff and now the continents are crumpling together and everything's getting all messed up and broken and twisted and, it works. It all has this order to it. That's why, it's not like telling us that is like, oh my goodness, scientists never thought of that before. This is revelation. It's like, no, they spent a whole three lines here in the book to tell you that for some truth reason. And that's what I keep trying to stress here. The point is not to just inform yourself about how some aquifers get supplied, but just to know, coincidentally, there's these clever ways that aquifers can get filled so that humans can live in desert regions and have water. Where they couldn't if beds hadn't gotten upturned like that. So way off over yonder, that straw was there that you could feed the water in. Think about it in a system like that, how cool that is.
Not to mention that it's a great filter.
Yeah, right, and all the filtering, right, that naturally occurs, right, yeah, it's all that too. Okay.
80 million years ago, great disturbances occurred in the Earth's crust. The western advance of the continental drift was coming to a standstill, and the enormous energy of the sluggish momentum of the intercontinental mass upcrumpled the Pacific shoreline of both North and South America and initiated profound repercussional changes along the Pacific shores of Asia. This circum-Pacific land elevation, which culminated in present-day mountain ranges, is more than 25,000 miles long, and the upheavals attendant upon its birth were the greatest surface distortions to take place since life appeared on Urantia. The lava flows, both above and below ground, were extensive and widespread.
So you can very much see things are starting to grind to a halt. It's not allowed to just gently shift and, you know, warp about. Things are starting to lock down, you know, and gears are grinding and things are breaking. You know, you, and you have stuff that the crust just radically fracturing. So you have all these, you know, all of this magma, you know, flowing all over, and you can tell that we are just about at the end point of continental drift. You know, as they, you know, almost, you know, directly said there, the western advance of the continental drift was coming to a standstill. See, so don't think about, you know, basically North America drifting, at, you know, quote unquote, as a plate, right? You know, before it was a plate, it's sort of just, things kind of just oozed, and there was a depression that eventually became the Atlantic, and kind of an elevation that eventually became North America. You know, it's initially all just one continent with low parts and high parts, and, you know, because there's water on the planet, those low parts go underwater. But, right, but you basically have just one continent until you really break it, you know, permanently into plates. Okay, and we're definitely reaching that point now. And you see how, you know, you're starting to have a Pacific plate, and stuff is, you know, slammed against that. And so you start to get the whole Ring of Fire issue beginning to form all the way around the Pacific.
25,000 miles, that's the whole circumference of the Earth. It's pretty long.
Right, right. They're just, you know, appreciating the, you know, they just, obviously they stress that to remind you of the global scale of this phenomenon. The whole planet is changing from continental drift to plate tectonics, and it has planetary consequences. Yeah, this massive planet scale phenomenon happens. The greatest surface distortions to take place since life appeared. You know, undoubtedly this, you know, had all kinds of impact, not only on killing off life, but giving life new challenges that it met, you know, all kinds of new adaptation to all sorts of new circumstances. All right.
Profound repercussions. Not exactly a neutral description.
Yeah, I mean, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, you know, sort of things, right? Newton's laws here are definitely in play, and you got the billiard balls bouncing off of each other, right? You know, things are clashing here in a basic, you know, Newtonian kind of way that you can understand. You see the sluggish momentum thing, you know, I mean, right? Yeah, you don't, once you have something moving, you know, of this mass, it doesn't stop on a dime. Okay, so you see here in the next one, now we're finally officially to the point that we can see is being so anticipated here. See what they say next.
75 million years ago marks the end of the continental drift. From Alaska to Cape Horn, the long Pacific Coast mountain ranges were completed, but there were, as yet, few peaks.
Okay, so, see, what happens then, you have the sort of the foundations of the mountain ranges are established in this final stage of ending continental drift and beginning plate tectonics. And then it's upon those foundations that the plate tectonic activity builds the mountains.
The peaks.
Right, the peaks, as you can see how they're describing it here. But you have sort of foundations that were laid by just this initial crunching and stuff as things finally ground to a halt. Right, see, and if you haven't been sure that you can believe what I've been saying all this time, I mean, you've got it right here, right? Marks the end of the continental drift. Okay. So you've got two options here now. Either you go, well, whoever wrote this book was very ignorant scientifically and, you know, had no clue. We all know that the continents are still moving. We measure it in great detail. Wow, they were ignorant. This is obviously not a revelation. This is garbage. Let's just throw it in with the lignite and burn it. Okay. Or, you know, you've reached the point where, okay, you know, that's not a valid option to interpret what's going on. Oh, they must mean, I'm supposed to use the term continental drift for something different than plate tectonics. And that thing came to an end, and plate tectonics began. Yes, see? Your challenge is to take the many possible false interpretations of any sentence in the book and find the one true interpretation. Right? Now, you can believe that there is no such thing as any true interpretation of this book. You may even go full skeptical and believe there is no such thing as truth. That's an option you can take if you want to. Right? But it is a revelation of truth, and there is a truthful interpretation. You have to find it, right? And it's there. And don't be surprised if current interpretations about various issues are different than what you need to properly interpret the Urantia book. Right? If we didn't need a different interpretation than we have right now, I wouldn't need this book in my lap. Right? The whole point is they're trying to get me to recognize that which I can't figure out on my own. We can't imagine just how different things were. We understand things now, and we use uniformitarianism to assume that it's always been that way back in the past. No, there was a kind of a cataclysmic shift from an old mode to a new mode, from continental drift to plate tectonics, like they're just talking about. There's this kind of cataclysm, right? And then there was a, in that regard, there was a uniformitarianism going forward. Okay, so just don't ever forget that the book can be nothing but error if you choose. And there's nothing that prevents me from erroneously interpreting every single sentence. Truth can't be given to me. None of these words impose truth upon me. They're just words. They're just facts. I have to get the truth, right? And so if you just approach it with your old wineskins, or make assumptions, well, scientists are established authorities. I can't question them. I've got to interpret it with their assumptions. Well, then you're just going to get nothing but error out of the book. And it's sad to record that there's very few people on the planet that can get anything but error from a revelation of truth, because they have a pretty white-knuckle grip on their preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and long-standing prejudices. Right? And it's not just science. It's just as much with all the religious content of the book as it is with the scientific content of the book. Right? I mean, you can interpret every single religious sentence in the book erroneously, and basically everyone does. Not because they want to, but you can't. It's trying to impose a totally different worldview on you, and trying to challenge you to put God into a new worldview. Don't put God in the old wineskin. He's already there. Because it'll just appear you have a new wineskin, but technically you have an old one. You just have the old one falsely aggrandized, and you're all the more self-righteous about it. it's less threatening, or should be, for many. If you have a PhD in science of some sort, this may not be the case, but talking about geology like this, say, or biology, might not be as threatening for you to come to terms with this radical transformation of worldview. And if you can build up your courage there in stepping away from the old order, thinking about things, and then genuinely think about that anew, that will be a precursor for you being able to take on the more personally poignant issues of your inner life and rethinking those. Because, of course, obviously, ultimately, that's what's going to make the biggest impact. If you can allow for a better relationship with God by giving him a better framework to work in, he can't work in anything except the framework that you supply for him. I mean, thought adjusters are described initially when they're put in your mind as what? Imprisoned. Right. Not because God isn't absolute and infinite, but he is humbly respectful of your free will. Until you free up that space, that adjuster, is hogtied. Can't do anything about it. No matter what you want him to do something about it, he's not magical. You've hogtied him. Until you unhogtie him, he's hogtied. The adjuster is always subservient to your will, right? As it says, nothing the adjuster can do. And if you impose that ignorant framework upon it, that tiny little thimble-sized framework, so you've got to work on that other consecration. There's plenty of will in play. That's imprisoning the adjuster. You need to work on consecrating your mind to the harmonious whole of the universe and liberate that that adjuster with that truth. Set him free with that truth. All right. So, continental drift is at an end. What do we have? What else do we have here?
The back thrusts of the halted continental drift continued the elevation of the western plains of North America, while in the east, the worn-down Appalachian mountains of the Atlantic coast region were projected straight up with little or no tilting.
Do you ever wonder why they're the high plains? Why is just the flat, boring stuff so high out west here? Right? The whole West has been pushed up because everything is slamming against the immovable object called the Pacific Plate. And it's all just pushing up. And you can notice how they even kind of, separated. There's kind of the West being uplifted and then as they say, the worn down Appalachian mountains are that uplifted. They go, well, what about in the middle? Yeah, what about in the middle, kind of in the Mississippi region? And right, that's a fracture zone. It's very, a lot of it is just a big mud pile from all of the inundations. Right, that have been in the middle part of the continent there so many times. It's not very solid stuff. And it's under all of this intense crumpling pressure. That's why one of these days St. Louis is going to be flattened. Right? I mean, that's a very, very fragile region in the center there. And it's going to have, 9-10 quakes, in it, because you've got all of this incredible pressure on just mush. There in the middle.
How about Memphis?
Yeah, right. Those areas in the middle there are, just back in the 1800s, there were some incredible quakes, in there. If there had been a lot of humans there, hundreds of thousands would have died. It's a very, it appears to be benign. You think, oh, the really bad places are along the rim of fire and stuff. Yeah, right in the middle there.
I didn't know that.
Pretty dangerous region. Because it's, there's just nothing solid to it. And it's under incredible pressure. But of course, it may not happen in our lifetime. And as the saying goes, if it doesn't happen in my lifetime, who cares?
How far is that going to stretch stretch north and south, or is it just going to, is the bottom just going to fall out from that south?
Well, you know, as you go far enough north, you start hitting the Canadian Shield, okay, and you've got really solid ground there. But just that swale down, you know, in the continental United States area, by the time you get to northern Minnesota, you're starting to get to the Continental Shield, and things are getting solid.
Right.
The Canadian Shield. Did I say Continental Shield? Canadian Shield. It is a Continental Shield, but it's a Canadian Shield. South of Minnesota, you know, and all the way down to the Gulf. That's a pretty mushy region.
Yeah, it is. Not so much where I'm from.
Yeah.
In Wisconsin. Mm. Although we do have a lot of water, we don't have a lot of mud.
But you have a lot of beer.
A lot of beer.
But we digress.
Yes, we will.
Okay. Meanwhile, back to the Cretaceous. Let's see. Where were we? Were we at 70 million? Okay. That's right, because we had so unlike a lot of the stuff, just one last little comment there about the straight up with little or no tilting. You know, just sometimes, when you look at it, it's very messy. You know, you can see these beds are just, just radically crumpled and folded back on themselves. And other areas, it's just been beautifully lifted, just perfectly horizontally up. It all depends on the dynamics of, what's going on. All right?
70 million years ago, the crustal distortions connected with the maximum elevation of the Rocky Mountain region took place. A large segment of rock was overthrust 15 miles at the surface in British Columbia. Here, the Cambrian rocks are obliquely thrust out over the Cretaceous layers. On the eastern slope of the Rocky Mountains, near the Canadian border, there was another spectacular overthrust. Here may be found the pre-life stone layers shoved out over the then-recent Cretaceous deposits.
So they're just trying to give you a little sense of just how radical this crunching that's going on, in the western part of the United States is. That you can literally have that very, have it break way down deep. And those very, very old beds, get shoved all the way up, plop on top of the current surface. Right? So that's what they're indicating there with those overthrusts. Can be just very huge like this. Just think about that. 15 miles, right, at the surface there. So, again, you're not saying anything that geologists don't know about. I mean, they can see here's Cretaceous, and oops, on top of it's Cambrian, for instance. But this is here for, like I said, a lot of this is so that you can get a better picture of just how messy the evolutionary process is relative to your false material idealism that we all tend to have, because we're taking our sense of ideals that's supposed to be just applied to spirit substance and applying it to the material, and getting these very false notions about something being existential that isn't. The dirt that you're walking on is not Havona dirt. It's not existential dirt. There's nothing sacred about it, quote unquote. It can be just horrendously disrupted, grotesquely deformed, et cetera.
There's an odd geological thing that happens in Wyoming that has caused me to wonder all my life, and I attended a lecture last summer by a geologist who teaches at the University of Wyoming, and I had a chance to ask him what it is. And what it is, in northern Wyoming, there are a whole lot of little pointy hills that are perfectly, they look like little mini volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all over the place, especially up in the area. grew up, and at the top of them is this stuff called scoria, or clinker. They call it sometimes clinker.
Right.
And that's a volcanic thing, but the rest of the thing doesn't seem to be made of that.
Right.
And there's this
capstone on the top.
And so I asked him, and he said that it's not that all of these things were little mini volcanoes.
Right.
He said what it is. I mean, that's wind erosion making these funny little pointy hills, but that the scoria on the top is left over from what was once a flat uniform layer everywhere of this volcanic stuff.
Right.
And it's just remained sort of perched there on the top of all of these funny little hills.
Right. See, and if it isn't a little volcanic capstone like that, it's a more resistant, you know, little sandstone bed, you know, with shale underneath it or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So you get those little islands left, you know, in the erosional surface. If you drive around the West a lot, you know, you'll come across some of those where you can see in the not too distant past that cap rock stuff is all fallen off.
Yeah.
And so now that, you know, the thing is on the way down, you know, it's going to erode away pretty quickly now that capstone is off. Yeah. And when they said the lava flows both above and below ground were extensive and widespread, see, you know, those kind of, you know, big sheets of, you know, lava spread out, you know, and producing an extensive bed, you know, like that, mm-hmm. that then can get eroded through and caps left. And Okay. Let's see here. All right. So here, the overthrust, right? So we have all these radical, you know, zones that have been just completely disrupted. Okay, what else we have?
This was an age of volcanic activity all over the world, giving rise to numerous small isolated volcanic cones. Submarine volcanoes broke out in the submerged Himalayan region. Much of the rest of Asia, including Siberia, was also still underwater.
So, see how far away we are from the plate tectonic Himalayas. Right, they're not there at all. The Himalayan region is submerged, and you have submarine volcanoes like the Hawaiian Islands. But again, like we were just stressing, you know, don't be surprised if you're looking around in Cretaceous regions geologically that you to find extensive volcanic, or at least the remnants of extensive volcanic deposits. Yeah. Because again, you've broken everything. Everything's just cracking and shattering. And so, you know, there's just, you know, volcanoes and magma all over the place because of this transition to plate tectonics.
65 million years ago, there occurred one of the greatest lava flows of all time. The deposition layers of these and preceding lava flows are to be found all over the Americas, North and South Africa, Australia, and parts of Europe.
I was hesitating, but I wanted to stop. I think I will. I think I will just stop like they did there and make one little comment right here. This is one of those spots where if you don't know about the date ratio between radiometric date and actual date, you hear geologists talking about something very radical happening 65 million years ago, and you go to the Urantia book and you go, what does it say? Does it say there was a huge meteor impact that killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago? And you look here and you go, no, it doesn't say that, but it says there occurred one of the greatest lava flows of all time. And you go, oh, the Urantia book is saying it wasn't a meteor impact, it was the greatest lava flows of all time that caused that. No. Right? There's a date ratio. Right? This is not, you know, what they're talking about. When they say 65 million years ago, that radiometric date, that ratio is 1.3. Divide 65 by 1.3, you get 50. You know, you get the end of the Cretaceous. You know, not close to the end like we are here. Cretaceous ends at 50. Right? this is not, you know, this is not the alternative explanation for what happened at the end of the Cretaceous that they currently try to rationalize with some catastrophism, you know, model. So just note that. It's just curious that it seems to kind of validate. There's an appearance that you can interpret falsely there. So just note that. Let's see here. Again, just like we were talking about, you can see we found all over the Americas and everything else. These very extensive deposits. Okay.
The land animals were little changed, but because of greater continental emergence, especially in North America, they rapidly multiplied. North America was the great field of the land animal evolution of these times, most of Europe being underwater.
See, so again, they're just stressing what I was saying a while back. Not much in the way of profound vertical evolution, but all the more and more profound horizontal evolution, see, because of the greater continental emergence there. But when they say the land animals were little changed, and then they say this is the great field of land animal evolution, you know, it looks like it's contradictory. But, you know, one is talking about vertical, not a lot of vertical, relatively speaking, but lots of horizontal evolution. Okay, and Europe's underwater. Okay.
The climate was still warm and uniform. The Arctic regions were enjoying weather much like that of the present climate in central and southern North America.
Okay, so we haven't gone fully to continental climate, but we're definitely not in the very, you know, long-standing full marine climate where the poles are like the tropics. But, you know, they've only gotten colder to the point where they're like central and southern North America. Okay. So you see how they give you that, the little clues like that, so you can kind of follow this evolution to the way it is now. You know, so obviously we're still a long ways away, even if you had the highlands up in the northern part of North America, you're still a long ways away from it being cold enough to start the continental glaciers. I mean, you don't have the conditions for continental glaciers here. Right? Right? Yeah. Just note that little bit there. Okay, what else they say?
Great plant life evolution was taking place. Among the land plants, the angiosperms predominated, and many present-day trees first appeared, including beech, birch, oak, walnut, sycamore, maple, and modern palms. Fruits, grasses, and cereals were abundant, and these seed-bearing grasses and trees were to the plant world what the ancestors of man were to the animal world. They were second in evolutionary importance only to the appearance of man himself. Suddenly, and without previous gradation, the great family of flowering plants mutated, and this new flora soon overspread the entire world.
Okay, so two things there that really stick out. That very amazing, you know, startling statement that the angiosperms were second in evolutionary importance only to the appearance of man himself. Pretty strong statement. Mm-hmm. So, see, again, like I was stressing a while back, see, I wasn't overplaying it. There's a lot of the evolution of humans embodied in flowering plants. No wonder humans have such an affinity to them, you know, find such beauty in them. You know? And again, think about that. How, you know, what is beauty? You know, remember, we've talked about this a lot. And, you know, to recognize that it's not as it appears. It's not a property of the object that you call beautiful. Right? You don't actually see beauty. Animals can't see beauty. Right? Beauty is recognized via insight. You're looking through that object, you know, and recognizing the pattern of the Isle of Paradise. The absolute of beauty is shining through a window of insight through that object. In the same way that it can flow through and be expressed by a human. And we can say that something is beautiful about what a human does or is. Just notice how they're giving that substance here. There's a lot of humanness, maybe you want to say, that's embodied in flowering plants, and our affinity to them is not, it's not just a curiosity. And it's innate. They're trying to stress that. Now, the thing that might be a little confusing is suddenly, they italicize it, it's like, wait a minute, I thought they said that back here at 90 million years ago, suddenly we had angiosperms. What's going on here? Did I find an error? No. What you found is an explanation of when you look at the evolution of angiosperms, subsequent to them appearing, there was suddenly there was this radical proliferation of them. That's the suddenly they're talking about here. And they're pointing out that it literally is a suddenly, that when you see this vast proliferation in the record, fossil record of angiosperms, it was literally because of not some sort of whole bunch of new avenues opening for horizontal evolution, say. Right? It was a vertical thing that suddenly there was this very much setting the stage for what's about to happen. We're about to have mammals, and that means you're about to have humans. And the fullness of flowering plants is there in anticipation of that. Okay. Yeah. So if you look up the about the angiosperms, you'll see that they talk about an event that you have to correct the date issue, but it's referring to this suddenly. Okay.
60 million years ago, though the land reptiles were on the decline, the dinosaurs continued as monarchs of the land, the lead now being taken by the more agile and active types of the smaller leaping kangaroo varieties of the carnivorous dinosaurs. But sometime previously, there had appeared new types of herbivorous dinosaurs, whose rapid increase was due to the appearance of the grass family of land plants. One of these new grass-eating dinosaurs was a true quadruped, having two horns and a cape-like shoulder flange. The land type of turtle, 20 feet across, appeared, as did also the modern crocodile and true snakes of the modern type. Great changes were also occurring among the fishes and other forms of marine life.
So, I think. What's the name of the true quadruped they're referring to there? Every kid knows this dinosaur. Triceratops! Yes. And you go, two horns? Why is it called tri? Well, you remember, they have two definitive big horns. They've got a tiny little horn on the end of their snout. Right? And then, of course, the big cape-like shoulder flange. Yes, it's the Triceratops who's made his appearance here in the late Cretaceous. If you, saw any of the Jurassic Park movies, you probably can guess what they're referring to there with the leaping kangaroo varieties of carnivorous dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Raptors. Yes. So we've got the raptors and we've got Triceratops.
Big turtles.
And great big turtles. you know, and remember, we're like I said, we're getting we're coming down in the date ratio, right? You know, with each step we take here, that ratio is dropping a little bit. But you know, you're still off, like I said, by, you know, it's not 65 million years ago; it's 50 million years ago when you get to the end of the Cretaceous. But that in subsequent to that, the end of the Cretaceous, it's going to come down quick, very quickly, and get down to a ratio of one. Mm-hmm. And that issue is about to be alluded to in the next paragraph. Oh, you got something?
Well, so there's a time chunk from where it kind of dipped down to 1.4, then it kind of did a slope back to 1.6, and now it's sloping down to
1. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, remember, it came down, you know, quite rapidly from 4 to 1.4, and then, you know, there's been this slow, gradual... And then now, I mean, relative to that, how gradual it went from 1.4 to 1.6, it's coming down, you know, quite quickly here.
You could plot a shape versus time for that
thing. Yeah.
Get tactile sensing.
Yeah, and, okay, so like I said, this next paragraph, you'll see, we get some more clues.
The wading and swimming pre-birds of earlier ages had not been a success in the air. Nor had the flying dinosaurs. They were a short-lived species, soon becoming extinct. They, too, were subject to the dinosaur doom, destruction, because of having too little brain substance in comparison with body size. This second attempt to produce animals that could navigate the atmosphere failed, as did the abortive attempt to produce mammals during this and a preceding age.
Okay. Remember, John, you asked me about this way back, and I told you we'll be getting to it in a bit. Here it is. So, this first came up back here in the Triassic, where they said several million years later, the first mammals appeared. You know, this was way back, you know, in the 140 million years ago block. And it said several million years later, the first mammals appeared. They were non-placental and proved a speedy failure. None survived. This was an experimental effort to improve mammalian types, but it did not succeed on Urantia. Okay, and you noted the experimental word there, and we're wondering, well, what do they mean by that? Do they mean because it's an experimental world? Is that why that word is there? And I said, well, wait a little bit. Okay, so now notice here how they throw in that last little chunk, as did the abortive attempt to produce mammals during this and a preceding age. Okay, that preceding age, you know, I just read there again. And you see, you know, attempt. Okay, that seems to validate what your suspicion was back there, that it wasn't, it seemed like they were talking about that the life carriers were doing an experiment. Right, separate from the fact that yes, it's an experimental world, but a more specific experiment. You know, making an attempt that failed. And so the thing that you can be kind of curious about is what I was just reminding you about with the whole date ratio thing. Wondering if the reason that they had it slowly. The activity level slowly increasing, you know, until it reached that, you know, when you see it indirectly here in the date ratio, if they're slowly boosting this sub-electronic activity for reasons that we can't understand, right, over that long span of time of hundreds of millions of years there, reaching that apex when these experiments are happening, you know, and then those experiments failing, you know, and then you see it being brought down pretty quickly. It's kind of suspicious.
Yeah,
see, that maybe that, you know, like I said, I mean, you have such rough figures to get this ratio with. It's a little, you know, it's barely two significant digits that you have. Okay, so it's a little hard to know if that's an actual slow up ramp. You know, or if it really is basically steady and then it drops. But it's kind of suspicious that it actually is, you know, this gentle little increasing of something for these experiments. Right? And then the experiments don't work, and so, okay, we're going to kind of just bring it down. And definitely, you got to rapidly bring it down, it appears, so that when you have basically modern mammals, it's down to, you know, to the current level. You know, this sub-electronic activity and its impact that we don't understand, it has this side effect that, you know, we notice in the date ratio. You know, so you can use the date ratio as a, you know, as a substitute for, you know, for this mysterious stuff that they might be doing with these experiments. Yeah. So that's what, you know, my speculation is that is you've got something there with these experiments they're doing. Why, I obviously don't know.
Did you discover this date ratio anomaly yourself by just...
Right, the way you do that, I mean, is you just...
I mean, that's brilliant of you.
Well, it's. I mean, yes and no, maybe. But, I mean, all you have to do is just, you know, eventually notice that, wait a minute, when I look in the book here under 65 million years ago, and I look what they're describing, that's, well, if I look up when the geologists are describing those same events... They don't call that 65 million years ago. They call that older than that. And not just there, but every single thing in the book here, right? You just, you match up the events, and you notice the dates don't match. You know, and at first you're thinking, well, I don't know what the heck to make of that. And then you can go, just out of curiosity, okay, the dates don't match. I wonder if there's any pattern to it. Well, let me just try randomly dividing a couple of them. Huh, that gives me about 1.5. How about those two? Huh, that gives me about 1.5. How about those two? Huh, that gives me about 1.5. And I'm, wait a minute here, this is not random. There's some pattern. So then I just, you know, did them all. And then you see, oh, so it starts out at a ratio of 4, and then they bring that down when they start life. And you see all this stuff that there's nothing random about it. It's very systematic, seems to be tied to the evolutionary process. Right? The life carriers are instructing the master physical controllers to regulate the sub-electronic environment relative to their evolutionary plan.
Which doesn't work, things didn't work, which means what? On the supreme scale of things.
They tried an experiment and the supreme didn't uphold it. You know, the mother didn't uphold that experiment.
As bright as they are.
Right. You know?
No, but they got calibration out of it.
But they definitely got calibration out of it, yeah. I mean, they definitely got information out of it. But now they don't explain, well, why were you trying to do these things in a different way? You know, maybe they're trying to figure out a scheme. Maybe there's certain worlds that they haven't figured out a scheme to do life on them yet. You know, and so they run experiments. It's like, well, you know, could you do it like this? You know, and then maybe we could, you know, take that, the essence of that, and, you know, apply that, you know, on that different kind of a world, and you could get inhabited life on that kind of a world that's normally, I mean, you could speculate about why they might be doing it.
What would a non-placental mammal be, an egg-laying mammal?
Well, we got two types. I mean, you've got, you know, an egg-laying one, like we know about, like a platypus, say, okay? Or you got all kinds of, you know, like kangaroos and whatnot. You got marsupials, you know, that are non-placental. You know, so you have egg-laying, and you have placental, and you have sort of in between, you know.
Yeah.
Like a kangaroo, it's like sort of half placenta, half egg, you know, the way those babies are gestated. You're trying to get to placental. You know, until you get a placental mammal, you don't have something that's very definitively pre-human. and so basically the fact that we still have a few non-placental mammals, you know, they're just, you know, you might even speculate that that's only because it's a decimal world. You know, maybe on a normal world you don't have tangents like that, you know. You know, and it all just goes very definitively in a placental fashion up to humans.
An opossum?
Right, you got opossums and opossums. You know, you got all these different marsupials.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you have just a very few egg-laying mammals, but you got, you know, you have quite a few different marsupials. All right, let's see. Did we get everything there? We got a comment on the. You've got this other issue with trying to get to an air navigator that is trying and not making it. Also, and just you'll see they bring that up here in a second. Let's read this next block, and then I'll finish commenting on that.
55 million years ago, the evolutionary march was marked by the sudden appearance of the first of the true birds, a small pigeon-like creature which was the ancestor of all bird life. This was the third type of flying creature to appear on Earth, and it sprang directly from the reptilian group, not from the contemporary flying dinosaurs, nor from the earlier types of toothed land birds. And so this becomes known as the Age of Birds, as well as the declining age of reptiles.
So a couple things there. One, curiously, so both with the flying issue and with the mammal issue, the third time's the charm. Curious. just FYI. Don't know what to make of that.
Well,
but
saying came from somewhere.
Twice there, third time was a charm. You notice that here again we have sprang directly from the reptilian group. So unlike current scientists, you know, obviously are biased to think, they're looking at various pre-bird things and thinking, well, the birds must have come from the pre-birds. It's like, no, the birds, they went all the way back to the reptilian. It was a totally new suddenly out of that foundation. Yeah, and if
pigeon, right?
Yeah, and giving you a pigeon like a creature, and you know, if you aren't familiar, when they say toothed land birds, you've probably heard of, there's a very famous toothed land bird fossil. What is it?
Archaeopteryx.
Yes, Archaeopteryx, right? And so yeah, Archaeopteryx is the famous one, and there's some others that they found since then. That's what they're referring to, and you know, and that idea that it was the missing link, right? That you went from, you know, dinosaurs to, you know, those toothed birds, and then to true birds, and even now there's some scientists that aren't quite so certain that you know, that specifically Archaeopteryx was the precursor. See, here they're saying no, it had nothing to do. It's a totally parallel, separate thing. That was trying to get to true birds and didn't go all the way. You know, it was a jump that didn't jump high enough. It jumped halfway there. And so it's kind of like half reptile, half bird. It needed to jump again, and then when you jumped the third time, you jumped all the way. Okay? All right, so that's
we've been pigeonholed once again.
Uh-oh, we've been pigeonholed once again. Yes, a groaner.
I was going to chirp.
Okay, so yeah, that's what's going on there. I mean, you notice how they don't spoon feed it. I mean, they leave it to you to figure out its Triceratops, and right. I mean, they're trying to encourage you to engage it, you know, with some knowledge. All right, let's read through the rest of this here. It's pretty straightforward here. Let's see if we can get it finished here.
Section 4: The End of the Chalk Period. The Great Cretaceous Period was drawing to a close, and its termination marks the end of the great sea invasions of the continents. Particularly is this true of North America, where there had been just 24 great inundations. And though there were subsequent minor submergences, none of these can be compared with the extensive and lengthy marine invasions of this and previous ages. These alternate periods of land and sea dominance have occurred in million-year cycles. There has been an age-long rhythm associated with this rise and fall of ocean floor and continental land levels. And these same rhythmical crustal movements will continue from this time on throughout the Earth's history, but with diminishing frequency and extent.
Okay, so in rough terms, I mean, not literally, you don't have a you know, precisely 1 million-year cycle. I mean, it's just, you know, on the scale of millions of years, as we've seen. That's what they mean by that. But the biggie there is, you know, they're trying to give you a truth flowing through that, okay? Things have been changing, you know, varying like that forever, as we've just read through most of it. And that didn't just magically stop, right? Any more than the initial variable star stopped being completely a variable star, you know, our sun, you know, it still has a cycle to it, like the sunspot cycle and stuff. It's a residual of that. This stuff is going to continue on. See, so again, you know, Florida's a sandbar, guys, okay? it's not an eternal Havona object. And they're trying to remind you of that right here. I mean, you know, going forward is, you know, it's a long ways away from the fifth stage of light and life. There's a lot of just evolutionary give and take that's still going to happen on this planet. Things are going to come and go. Shorelines are going to change, right? It's not evil. It's just part of the natural system, right? And whether or not humans have any direct involvement is secondary. After all, eventually humans are supposed to have a more and more direct involvement in all this stuff. All of this is just us anyway, right? I mean, any short continent going underwater is part of the evolution of humans, like I've been trying to stress. Right? It's not somehow a corruption of the history of the Earth. If we can directly understand a relationship between shorelines and human activity, it's all always been directly related. Right? It's all one system. Activity of humans is not evil. Now, it doesn't mean that we defile the Earth, you know.
Wantonly.
You know, wantonly, yes. Right?
We have done that, though.
But we, you know, we can't think in such simplistic dichotomies about this. Man. We are supposed to have an impact on the Earth. We have to get to the point where we have very definite impact on the Earth, because we have to choose then to have the positive impact. Mm-hmm. Right? Until you can have some impact, you can't have a positive or negative impact. We're not supposed to have the age of light and life is not humans not impacting the Earth. The age of light and life is humans radically in control of the Earth. You've got to learn how to take control of it.
Right? We have to learn to destroy it first, apparently. Right.
You can't have creativity without destructivity. Right? And so, you know, there's an evolutionary process. The creativity of all those beds got destroyed. Or, you know, they even said right here, the dinosaur doom, comma, destruction. See how they emphasize that through in that parenthetical? It's part of the process. Okay.
This period also witnesses the end of the continental drift and the building of the modern mountains of Urantia. But the pressure of the continental masses and the thwarted momentum of their age-long drift are not the exclusive influences in mountain building. The chief and underlying factor in determining the location of a mountain range is the pre-existent lowland, or trough, which has become filled up with the comparatively lighter deposits of the land erosion and marine drifts of the preceding ages. These lighter areas of land are sometimes 15 to 20,000 feet thick. Therefore, when the crust is subjected to pressure from any cause, these lighter areas are the first to crumple up, fold, and rise upward to afford compensatory adjustment for the contending and conflicting forces and pressures at work in the Earth's crust or underneath the crust. Sometimes these upthrusts of land occur without folding, but in connection with the rise of the Rocky Mountains, great folding and tilting occurred, coupled with enormous overthrusts of the various layers, both underground and at the surface.
Basically, you notice how they're kind of giving geologists a solid framework to think in there, to go back and reinterpret the nature of mountain ranges, for instance, you know, to not think of them just as generated by the current plate tectonic processes, but to take in the full spectrum of, like I was indicating, how continental drift set the stage for what plate tectonics did then subsequently in those various regions. That's basically what they're giving you there. I don't think we need to go too much on that. But you notice they keep mentioning the Rocky Mountains, which always catches our attention here.
That's on purpose.
They're anticipating us.
Yeah, it must be all about us. Yes. No, it's just that the Rocky Mountains are such a significant phenomenon geologically on the planet. A prime example of certain processes.
So is it basically saying that then they were formed by up-tilting, so to speak? In other words.
Well, you got all kinds of different things happening. Stuff, they're about to mention some of this, so we don't want to. But you've got stuff that's being lifted up. I mean, you obviously know the beds that were once horizontal are tipped up into the flat irons, right? Okay, right. Yeah. See, that was obviously part of building them. That there was an upthrust like that, right? You just need to sort out all the details and the precursors, and they're trying to give clues to all that. Just one other thing to comment. I mean, there are definitely areas, way up high in the Rocky Mountains where it was an old, the old flat erosional surface, way down low at a low elevation. And it was just lifted up beautifully horizontally and is up there in the midst of mountains all around it. And it's a very ancient erosional surface. It used to be, down at the Great Plains level. It is now way up there in the hills. Okay.
The oldest mountains of the world are located in Asia, Greenland, and Northern Europe, among those of the older East-West systems. The mid-age mountains are in the Circum-Pacific group and in the second European East-West system, which was born at about the same time. This gigantic uprising is almost 10,000 miles long, extending from Europe over into the West Indies land elevations. The youngest mountains are in the Rocky Mountain system, where, for ages, land elevations had occurred only to be successively covered by the sea, though some of the higher land remained as islands. Subsequent to the formation of the mid-age mountains, a real mountain highland was elevated, which was destined subsequently to be carved into the present Rocky Mountains by the combined artistry of nature's elements.
A little bit of poetry there. Quickly there, see how the early part of that is reminding you of how, to think in terms of kind of one continent, really before plate tectonics, even if you effectively had, the Atlantic Ocean and stuff, not like now. You can talk about mountain ranges that seem to be magically going through what's now the Atlantic Ocean, like they're talking about there. It's like, well, not back before you had the current plate tectonic like Atlantic Ocean. It was different. And so just shades of that in there. And again, they're just kind of giving, notice how they're giving these kind of just thumbnail sketch overviews so that the geologist has a basic framework to think about the details in. Geologists can work out the details. They can't give us that. Even though, that's not the point, right? But the geologists need the basic framework that there's no way to get true geology. And that's the point of the revelation, to give you what you need so that we can produce true geology. Okay.
The present North American Rocky Mountain region is not the original elevation of land. That elevation had been long since leveled by erosion and then re-elevated. The present Front Range of mountains is what is left of the remains of the original range, which was re-elevated. Pikes Peak and Long's Peak are outstanding examples of this mountain activity, extending over two or more generations of mountain lives. These two peaks held their heads above water during several of the preceding inundations.
Everyone in the Front Range loves that sentence. picturing Pikes Peak and Long Peak as islands, like the Hawaiian Islands, poking up out of the ocean.
Excellent indeed.
You know, the trick is just to figure out, well, exactly what was the elevation of everything. You know, you can, you know, it was radically different. So it's hard to, you know, it's not like you just fill up the current land with water and have the two peaks sticking out, you know. Mm-hmm. But you get the basic point. It's, you know, it's a poetic delight, even if it's hard to think about it literally scientifically. All right.
Biologically as well as geologically, this was an eventful and active age on land and underwater. Sea urchins increased while corals and crinoids decreased. The ammonites of preponderant influence during a previous age also rapidly declined. On land, the fern forests were largely replaced by pine and other modern trees, including the gigantic redwoods. By the end of this period, while the placental mammal has not yet evolved, the biologic stage is fully set for the appearance in a subsequent age of the early ancestors of the future mammalian types.
If you're kind of wondering, why is this section in here? Why are they kind of giving you this little review? You kind of get the answer right there. See, they're just trying to, you know, remind you before they go to the mammalian era of what the basic sweep of things is that is setting the stage for the very immediate precursors of humans. So that's the point of this little section here, is to kind of just get that basic picture of how all of this has come together so that the stage is fully set, that it's a whole, that that there's a system here that's evolving. Not just a bunch of randomly, coincidentally related parts. You know, or the parts are what they are and everything has to just, you know, deal with it. And it's not that way. You know, it's designed, you know, in the purposing that's behind all of this evolutionary process to have a systematic quality to come together and be just what it needs to be. Every moment of time is a divine dispensation. Yeah, not just the end. Now is just as much a divine dispensation as somewhere deep in light and life. No difference in quality of how much divinity is inherent in what's present. Okay? The finger snap of creation isn't you know, divine only at the end of the finger snap. It's divine all the way through it. Okay? Yeah, it's a very important lesson.
And thus ends a long era of world evolution, extending from the early appearance of land life down to the more recent times of the immediate ancestors of the human species and its collateral branches. This, the Cretaceous Age, covers 50 million years and brings to a close the pre-mammalian era of land life, which extends over a period of 100 million years and is known as the Mesozoic. Presented by a life carrier of Nebanon, assigned to Satania, and now functioning on your ranch.
Ta-da! Yeah, so there you have it. Again, you can see in that last sentence there, stressing just what I was saying. The immediate ancestors of the human species. Right? They just, you know, that's the whole point. They're trying to get you to feel how this is building up. And its wholeness is more and more apparent. If the revelators coordinate the facts for you like they have here, you know, so that you can really appreciate how this is indeed a system. And it's the whole point of all this complexity and mystery is will creatures. The universe was designed to be inhabited by will creatures. All right, so we'll get into mammals then next time. And the pace, like I said, picks up even more and more. It's like boom, 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 boom. The events start to happen. Yep.
Well, as it says in this last sentence, presented by a life carrier of Nebadon, assigned to Satania and now
Right. I mean, remember that these papers are written by the one of the life carriers that designed and guided all this life.
So is it still...
And there's you know, there's a group of them still here.
Okay.
Right? They took that oath. You know, they wouldn't, you know, meddle around with things. You know, post will creature. You know, and a group of them stayed on, and one of those that's still here. Cool. Yep. You know, for the last.
Surprise us with something new.
Yeah, they pointed at, okay, you're going to write some papers. Yes, sir. Right, the Revelatory Commission behind Part 3 here, you know, got to, you know, one of our resident life carriers to write the paper. So he knows of that which he speaks. He designed this life. One of them, you know, the group that designed it and shepherded it and all that time. And did experiments. And
good or bad.
Yep. Okay. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.